So then I would like to move to the next item, item 12. Mr. Harris.
So for those of you who were on the tour previously to Elkhorn Slough, you recall there were a number of questions that we talked about and asked, we actually specifically, for example, asked the Elkhorn Slough staff if they would come back at some point and give us a presentation on the historical wetlands, I guess, or historical extent of the Elkhorn Slough. So that is so that's the first presentation number 12 that you're going to hear, and then 13 is an additional one on just water quality.
Okay, so if we could have the presenter for the first item, and since I'm the newly appointed timekeeper, what's your approximate presentation time?
About 20 minutes.
All right, thank you.
So you'll keep me on task here. And I'm going to stand here so that I can use the mouse to point things out.
Sure.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes. And if you can introduce yourself.
I will do that.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Stand here.
Can I stand there and use the mouse?
No.
Let's see if that'll work. That sounds good.
Does that mouse work?
Is that working?
I'm not sure. Why don't you play with it a little bit?
Okay, we're going to play with it just a minute, and then I will introduce myself if that's okay with you. I'm not seeing a mouse.
Okay.
I'm going to go back. And if this one doesn't work, then I'll just walk you through things. I do see the mouse here, so I'm going to stand here if that's okay with you. All right, well, thank you for letting me speak to you today. My name's Andrea Woolfolk, and I'm the stewardship coordinator at the Elkhorn Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve. And with my 20 minutes today, I'd like to accomplish three things. First, I'd really like to share a work in progress, a map of historical wetlands of the North Monterey County, so a little more than Elkhorn Slough. And this is a draft map that I've been working on for the last year. I would like to share the historical data that I'm using to create this map with you. And at the very end, I'd like to provide some web access to you so you can use some of these historical maps back at your office or at home if you're interested. So let me start off with historical ecology. What is it? Historical ecology is the collection, compilation, synthesis, and analysis of diverse historical data sources. So things like journals, historical maps, newspaper articles, and that's done in order to help us understand past landscapes, habitat distribution, where animals were, how things functioned physically. Why would you want to do that? Well, as land managers or people who have management authority, it can be pretty helpful in a few ways. First, using reliable firsthand accounts can help us understand past and current conditions that we see in the landscape. For me, it's important because it can provide insight into forgotten habitat types. I think important for a lot of us is that historical ecology can help us identify landscape-level linkages and functions, and it can help us understand the potential to protect and or restore land and water that we manage. Now, there are a lot of limitations to historical ecology, and I'm not going to go into those in detail right now, but I do want to just kind of sum that up by saying that historical ecology is not a template from which to recreate the past. We don't use it to try to turn back the clock anywhere. It's really meant to just help us understand why things look the way they do today, and it helps us plan for the future on how we might want to manage things. All right, so I promised you a draft map. Like I said, this is something I've been working on for about a year now, although I've been helping collect information for about 15 years now, so this is a labor of love for me. This draft map at this point includes information brought in from about 35 historical maps. And the next step after this talk will be to incorporate historical information that's coming from texts as well. So what I'd like to do is just start off with a base map so you understand where we're looking. And so as you look on here, you'll see Pajaro River at the top, and we won't talk about that at all for the rest of this talk. Elkhorn Slough will play a major role for the rest of this discussion. Castroville and Salinas are important landmarks as we walk through this history. The Salinas River will play a large role in my talk, and then I have Marina here just for reference. And? And for Bruce.
Did he bribe you for that?
No, I didn't know Bruce was here, but yes, it's for you, Bruce. All right, so superimposed on that particular map is my habitat map that I've been working on, and so I want to point out two major features to begin with. First, if you look at the top of the legend, I've got light blues, and those represent freshwater habitats. So those include freshwater marshes, which of course are areas that have water on them part of the year, or at least part of the year, and include vegetation that grows up through them. Open water habitats, such as lakes and ponds, and then rivers and freshwater sloughs are shown in light blue. And of course, the Salinas River falls into that category down there. The other major category of habitats are tidal habitats, and so the dark blue shows subtidal channels. Mudflats, tidal mudflats are shown in browns. I have quite a bit of tidal marsh, and I have different categories for that, but mostly those are encompassed with that darker green color and some hatched markings. And then I have riparian trees as well. Willows pop up as really bright green in this map. So what I'd like to do is now strip away that background image just so you can see the habitats a little more clearly. And I'm hoping that as you look at this, two major themes might pop out for you like they have for me as well. And so let me point these out to you. The first is that these wetlands in North Monterey County were very connected. They were interconnected through their channels. And let me point this out to you. So the Salinas River used to make a very steep bank to the north instead of coming through the sand dunes. Most of the year. During large storms, the Salinas River would actually come through the sand dunes and exit there. But most of the year, it took this sharp turn to the north. It connected up with the Tembladero Slough, which was in turn connected to many of these freshwater lakes to the east. It also connected up with Morro Coho, which was connected to the Castroville Slough, which was connected to Elkhorn Slough, Bennett Slough, and these all had a shared mouth to the ocean. The other thing that I'd like to point out that really jumps out at me is just how extensive the wetlands were in this region. Of course, some of these are still here, but some of them may be forgotten habitat types, at least for some of us. Some of you may already know this. And I just want to point out where we're sitting today in Salinas relative to these wetlands. All right, so that's the map that I've been working on, but without knowing me or how much time I have spent on this, you may or may not believe that. So what I really wanted to do was show you the primary data that's being used to create this map. Again, the maps that I'll show you have already been incorporated in the map. The texts that I'll be reading have not been incorporated yet, and that'll be my next step. So let's look at the historical evidence for interconnected channels. What I want to do is start with a beautiful Rancho map that was drawn in 1836 that shows the area encircled in red here. So this was a Rancho map for the Bolsa Nuevo y Morro Coho, and this ranch belonged to the Castro family, and it included, as you can see here, Elkhorn Slough, Morro Coho, and the Castroville Slough, Tembladero, and then the large lake in the back, which was once known as Merritt Lake. So take a look at those shapes, because the next map actually captures those pretty well. Here we go. So again, this map was made in 1836, and it's written in Spanish, so let me put some English place names on here for us. And what you can see most prominently are Elkhorn Slough, the Estero here, Morro Coho, Castroville Slough down here, Tembladera, used to have an A instead of an O, which graded back into that big Merritt Lake area as well. And you can see San Miguel Canyon off to the side here. But the main thing that I want to show you on this map is how the river, Salinas River, connected up with the Tembladero, connected up with Morro Coho, and connected up with Elkhorn Slough, and they had a shared mouth, which in 1836 appears to have been in line with Morro Coho Slough. All right, and so let's jump forward about 25 years now to the American period. Once California became a state, the U.S. government sent in a lot of surveyors, and there's some beautiful maps from this period, and this is one of the most beautiful in my opinion. This is from the U.S. Coast Survey, done in 1854, and they were mapped the whole coastline, but they only went 1 mile inland, so this is just a little sliver of the wetland system. But what I want to point out here is it shows the Salinas River making that really treacherous churn to the north again. Oh, and this is two maps stitched together, that's why you see this funny little white area in the middle here. But you see the channel continuing to the north, connecting it with the mouth of Tembladero Slough here, with Morro Coho here, Elkhorn Slough, Bennett Slough, and then a shared mouth. It looks like the mouth probably moved between 1836 and 1854 because on this map it's shown north of Elkhorn Slough. I'm going to show you another map from the same year. Hopefully this shows up well on your screens. I think this one's gorgeous as well. This is a Rancho map that was done of the lower portion of the map that I just showed you. So what you're seeing here is the Salinas River, which back in 1854 was still known as the Monterey River, and then connecting up with the Tembladero Slough here. And then you can see the Tembladera, the shaking lands that made up the eastern portion of that. And the reason I want to show you this is just to show you how beautifully some of these maps overlay with our current aerials. So let's do a little bit of a close-up here. So now we're looking at just the Tembladera and the mouth of the Salinas River there. I'm going to put a 2012 aerial behind it, and you can start to see how well the Tembladera matches up with the channel today. And as well, you can see that the Salinas River has changed quite a bit. Today it's very straight, but there had been this bend. And if you actually remove the map, keep an eye on the Salinas River there, you can still see the scar where the river used to be. So it's really, these are really incredible maps. And it's been very fun working with them. All right, and now I'm going to read you through one of the texts that I haven't incorporated yet, but it's still, I think, a worthwhile text to read. So this was in the Castroville Argus in 1870. It was a boat trip taken down the Tembladero, up this Morro Cojo Slough, and then down Castroville Slough. And what I'd like to do is start by reading it together, and then I'll switch you over, and I'll just read to you. But let's start off together here. So this is from January 15th, 1870. The Tembladera has its rise in and is chiefly fed by two large and deep lakes. And I just want to point that out, that that was Merritt Lake and Espinosa Lake going into Tembladera. One lying about 2 miles east of Castroville and the other about the same distance southeast. About a month ago, we, in company with Mr. Juan B. Castro, he's the father of Castroville, Mr. Antonio Pomer, and Mr. Anderson, made the voyage down one channel and up the other. About 1 o'clock p.m., we got into a skiff on the Tembladera near Hicks Mill and proceeded leisurely down the stream 3 miles to the Salinas. So what I'm going to do here is then I'll just walk you through the trip that they took. So this is a contemporary, this is an aerial from 2012 or from Google Earth, and I've overlaid my habitat map in there so it makes sense as we walk through it. So we're going to start with my red star here, and I'll just read to you, and you can follow along. The channel for the first half mile was about 20 feet wide, with a growth of tules on one side and a depth of water from 3 to 4 feet. The remainder of the distance, the stream was clear of tules, widened to 40 or 50 feet, but had the same depth until near its confluence with the river, where it had 6 or 7 feet. We should judge the width of the Salinas to be 250 to 300 feet wide. The tide was low, and in one or two places sandbars showed themselves. Still, we found a channel all the way down. We turned into the Morro Cojo Slough. This slough, as it is called, was found to be about the same width as the river, having a depth of 8 to 9 feet of water, and no obstruction of any kind excepting a mudflat about 2 miles up. The Morro Cojo was alive with waterfowl, countless ducks of more varieties than we know how to properly name, gulls of all kinds, brants by the thousands, uncouth pelicans, and stately honkers in large flocks on wing, water, and land. About 2.5 miles from the river, we turned into the mouth of Castroville Channel, which here, and for about a mile, we should think, is from 75 to 100 feet wide, with a uniform depth of 8 and 9 feet. We moored our boat about 100 feet from the high ground in the northern corner of town, and nearly opposite the point from which we had started 4 hours and a half before. The tide was out, so we disembarked on the marsh. Had it been in, we could have run our boat to the town lots, where it is said to rise 3 or 4 feet here, and judging from the drift, we should judge it did. The entire distance from the river was clear of any growth such as tules and sedges, a clear, beautiful stream. And I just wanted to point out that here they talk about the Castroville Slough being 75 to 100 feet wide. Today, that's very much reduced. Here's an image of Castroville Slough today, and it's really mostly about 5 to 10 feet in width in most places along the slough today. And to wrap up these interconnected channels, I just want to point out that these were mapped repeatedly. And so here are just a few of those images from the mid-1800s to the early 1900s. So what changed? These water courses are still there, but they're not really quite as interconnected as they used to be. And so I'm going to give you 3 examples of water control structures that have gone in since. The first one has to do with the connection with the Salinas River and the rest of the channel system. In 1909 or 1910, for some reason that seems to be a little bit mysterious, the Salinas River was cut off from its northern arm. And that's shown pretty well in this 1933 map where it's the river itself is no longer connected. Today, that connection's been reestablished somewhat, but these two channels are connected with a tide gate. A lot of tide gates went into the system, and here's just one example from the 1880s. This particular map was drawn in the 1880s. It shows, I think this is Moss Landing Wharf here. This is the Salinas River and the Morococo Channel where it connects up. And there's a bulkhead that was put in the 1880s as described in this article from the Sentinel. In this particular article, they're talking about Morococo, but they mislabel it as Elkhorn Slough. And they describe in this short article that the floodgates there were arranged so that at low tide, the fresh water would open the gates, letting the water into the ocean, but the tide water would close them, permitting no water to pass up what they call Elkhorn Slough, but was really Morococo Slough. And then, of course, I have to mention how the mouth has been altered. Back in 1947, the Army Corps of Engineers came in to help create the Moss Landing Harbor. And what they did was they installed jetties right across from Elkhorn Slough, in line with Elkhorn Slough, deep into the mouth there. And so today we have a deeper and more permanent mouth. Before it was dynamic, it would move up and down the coast. And when that happened, the natural mouth, which at that point was north of Elkhorn Slough, closed. And so that's had implications for Elkhorn Slough habitats. All right, now I'm going to back up, and I'd like to start over with the extensive wetland system. So remember, I had two themes I was hoping to touch on. So now I'd like to talk about the extensive estuarine marshes, freshwater lakes, sloughs, and wetlands. And this is my last reading. But this one's a beautiful reading. This is from 1769 from the Portola expedition. This was the first overland expedition in California, and the first European one. And the expedition got lost. They were looking for Monterey, but they got to the Salinas River, and they weren't too sure where Monterey was. So on October 7th, they decided to head north in search of Monterey. They ended up going all the way to San Francisco. I just want to read to you from Father Crespi's journal from that day as they take off from the Salinas River and head through North Monterey County. Oh, and I'm going to superimpose my wetland map on this particular image, which shows the river here, and then Morococo way in the back here. All right. So Father Crespi writes, "We set out a little after midday from this place, which was on the Salinas River, taking up a north-northwest course. Shortly, we came onto a dry swamp, a swamp or dry lake that was very green with very lush mallows and other plants. Afterward, we came into hollows in among ranges of very low rolling knolls that were very much grown over with very good grasses. We have not seen better ones anywhere. We passed by four good-sized lakes that could be gotten around only with a great deal of toil after preparing some very miry crossings. We went 3 hours and stopped in a small valley close to a pool into a heathen village, which they must have abandoned shortly beforehand, as was evident from the traces. Also along was a soldier who kept a diary as well. His name was Miguel Costanzo, and he said of that same campsite on this lake that they saw a great number of cranes, the first we had seen on this journey. And I think a lot of people assume those were sandhill cranes. I'll show you one more Rancho map. This is one that would have been along the lake system between Castroville and Salinas. This was the Rincon de San John, which means the corner of the sloughs. And if you look in here, you can see there would be two sloughs. This is Alisal Slough, then this one, and just a few lakes in here. It was owned by the Barrondo family. And this map probably comes from the 1830s. And it's a very simple map, but it shows that there are Rancho included Alisal Slough here. I think this is the upper Tembladero shown here with a lake actually connected to it terminating in Barrondo Lake. And it was surrounded by a Sausalito, little willow grove, and another lake on the other side of the border. So a very simple but beautiful map. I'll read you one American account of the lakes as well. The chief peculiarity in the location of Salinas City is that it is in the midst of natural lakes, some of them of considerable depth and fed by springs. Entering Salinas on the Santa Rita Road, the traveler passes between two of these lakes, one of great depth. Entering by way of the Castroville Road, we pass several other lakes. On the south of the town, and some miles distance, there are several similar lakes. In fact, there's a chain of lakes of varying sizes reaching from Salinas City to Castroville. Some of these lakes are deep and permanent, others are shallow and surrounded by wide belts of marsh and tule. And just one more map is showing the extensive marshes in our area. I didn't want to omit the tidal marshes. So this is a soil survey done in 1925. The marshes around Elkhorn Slough are marked as gray. They're tidal marshes. And also around Morro Coho Slough, there are extensive tidal marshes as well. And then the green that shows along some of the edges of Elkhorn Slough was mapped as Alviso clay, which these mappers described as being overflowed at the highest tides and being somewhat brackish. And so those are shown along the Castroville Slough and upper Elkhorn Slough as well. All right, and what changed with a lot of these wetland systems of wetland reclamation? And I just have one slide on this. This is from 1901, the soil survey of the lower Salinas Valley. Both the image, the caption, and the text are from that report. And they wrote, "The land in proximity to the sea is often rendered unfit for cultivation by the effects of brackish tidewater, and in a few cases, existing slough channels afford an outlet for drainage of limited areas of this land. Much of the land, the Monterey County farm and vicinity, has been drained to such sloughs." And I wanted to end up with just a couple of 20th century maps, and these are things that you'll be able to use. I'll give you web access to these. This particular one is from, this is 1916, and it's showing that lake system that we've been talking about between Castroville Slough, so here's the Tembladero Slough, Castroville and Salinas right here, and you can see there were many lakes in between. And in fact, I got this map just two doors down from the recorder's office. It's part of a much larger book. It's called Reclamation Book Number 2. And it comes with some incredible blueprint drawings of the whole wetland system. It includes the depth of these, the channels, the lakes, and incredible detail in the plants. So you can map the willows and the tules. Here are just two more images from that series. This particular map is also online. This one's from 1906. It doesn't include the northernmost lakes, but it's still a very, very accurate map. And I wanted to point out one of the pictures. This is kind of light on your screens, but this is one that's from that book I just mentioned. And you can see the Tembladero going into Castroville, and it includes things like a little marsh heading in the lots and a willow grove here, so I can use those to map. All right, finally, the last thing I wanted to do was to give you access to a few of these maps. These are in a format that can be used in Google Earth. So if you wanted to go to our website, and the website is there at the bottom, elkhornslough.org, habitat restoration/historical ecology tools, you can actually get these, a few of these maps. And I'm going to show you how to do that. So if you were to enter this address in your web browser, it would bring up this particular web page. And if you wanted to view some of these maps in Google Earth, I would highly recommend that you start with the README file. Was that my time up? I've got probably 1 to 2 minutes. Okay. So what you would do if you're interested, these particular maps are huge. They're about 10 to 20 megabytes, and Google Earth wasn't really designed to deal with these, but it can. But if you want to do this, go to the README file, and it'll walk you through these steps that you can use them. So if you've decided that you want to do it, and you've read the README file, then go down to one of the maps that you're interested in, and they're listed down here on the page. I'm going to pick a 1917 topo map, for example. Right-click it, save it to your hard drive. And then once it's on the hard drive, go ahead and right-click on it, and then open it to an open with Google Earth. Like I said, these maps are very large, and so Google Earth will struggle with them for a little bit. So it'll take a little while to load, and the first thing you're going to see if you bring these up is this big white sheet on the top of your Google Earth image, and it's going to have arrows on it. Wait through that, and in just a minute it will load, and you'll see something like this. It'll take that map and just plop it right on top of the recent aerials. And so this is an example of, you can see one of the lakes down here at the bottom, the east end of Morro Coho, and part of Elkhorn Slough as well. And what's really nice about this is then you can zoom in, and if you've got the topography set, then you can really see the hill shading, which can be gorgeous. And then if you use this nifty little tool over here, it brings up a slider so that you can take the map that you're looking at and make it transparent. And you can slide it back and forth, which is a really powerful thing to do. Then you can look at the map and compare it to conditions today, and you can look for land use changes yourself. And so that is what I had for today. I hope that through this talk you've gotten a sense of the historically connected channels and extensive wetlands, and that you've got a way to play with some of these maps back at your office. All right.
And this is an opportunity for the rest of us to ask for some more questions. I particularly liked the journey.
Yeah, thanks.
And the tracing of a journey. That was very powerful. So thank you. So questions? Yes, Mr. Young.
Dr. Wolf. Andrea, thank you.
Oh.
It's just spectacular.
Oh, my pleasure.
We tend to not get any historical perspective on what we're currently doing with anything with respect to the past. So, you know, it helps to ground, at least it informs kind of, you know, my thinking of what I'm doing. Two questions for you. One is, can you go over again, why was the Salinas rerouted?
That's a mystery. So there are different theories out there, and I don't know. One theory, what's been put forth, is that it happened in 1906 from the earthquake. But there were maps after 1906 that still show that connection. And so that one's, we're skeptical. Okay. We don't really think it was the earthquake. Some people have thought that maybe the farmers were trying to do flood protection, and so they may have just built up a levee there to protect, because there were lots of farms along that northern reach. My own personal theory is at the time that this seems to become disconnected, locals were lobbying pretty hard for a harbor at Moss Landing, and one of the criticisms of that harbor had been that you would end up with these floodwaters from the Salinas River. So that's my own personal hypothesis. I've got no way to back that up, so. But we don't know.
Okay.
The short answer is we don't know.
All right.
Was Mr. Jeffrey involved with that?
You look back at maps, you'll probably see my name on it somewhere.
Well, I couldn't resist.
But she's right. A lot of speculation that the earthquake changed some of the mouth of the river. Flood control was another issue. And, of course, when Spreckles built the factory, they floated the bricks up on the barges up to Salinas River to build the Spreckles factory. Mm-hmm. So that was a big issue. And, of course, then they had the push to build the harbor. There's some remains of a dock that wants to be rebuilt by the Marine Lab in Moss Landing, which was the old dock where the sailing ships would come in and unload. So there's a lot of history in that particular area, and I haven't seen some of these maps. I've seen some of them years ago, but you've done a lot of research to show. And the overviews and the lapping of the two maps and how similar that they are, and the tools and instruments they had to use in those days compared to what we have today, you know, how accurate that they have been. And of course, you didn't point out that the Elkhorn Slough was actually a freshwater facilities, and that's most of it is now salt water except for the upper end of the Elkhorn Slough itself.
I didn't point that out because I don't think that the evidence supports that particular interpretation of history. I mean, we have a lot of evidence that maybe 2,000 or 3,000 years ago it did become freshwater. We know that from pollen cores. And certainly in the period that I was just showing, there was more freshwater input. We know that there were a lot of springs in the area, so there was definitely a lot of groundwater, and the Salinas was more collected, more connected, and so there would have been seasonally much more freshwater flow into there. So it's saltier today than it would have been 100, 150 years ago, but I don't think it was freshwater. The pollen core shows marshes being there beyond 2,000 years ago. There were more tules, but there was still a lot of pickleweeds. I think it was more of a brackish habitat, probably
brackish.
Hovering around 20.
Yeah, there was some seepage.
Today it's like 35 parts per thousand,
no
so it's definitely
about
changed.
That.
Yeah.
And of course, when you know high water flows in the Salinas River, and they breached north of Moss Landing as we know it today, Elkhorn Slough. And, of course, they'll let salt water in at that particular time. But, my understanding that the rest of the year, when the flows weren't as great, then it sealed back up again. And so they had more fresh water added.
So we've been able to find the accounts of it sealing up at least in the 1800s, and it looks like that it would seal up just for a few weeks in the winter, which is not intuitive. I thought it would seal up during the summer. But the only accounts are during the winter when you would have these large storm events come in, and I guess the waves would actually start to build up that sandbar. But it appears before there was a lot of reclamation that the tidal prism was large enough to keep the mouth open most of the year, which was a little surprising to quite a few of us. You know, it's just for a small sliver of time. That's just when they were doing the shipping up the slough. So we have lots of accounts of what the conditions were at that point. But certainly, as there was a lot of reclamation, there was less tidal prism, and the mouth would close quite frequently in the 20s and 30s, and that's when you ran into those conditions of a very lagoonal Elkhorn Slough.
Thank you. Dr. Hunter, next. And
I had actually two questions.
Oh, sorry, that's right. We only got one thing.
But it was okay. We got sidetracked.
So this is part two?
This is just the second part of it.
All right.
I was going to ask Russ, though, if he was in that early photograph in the boat.
Well, you saw that little guy at the end of the boat there who was kind of hanging on for dear life.
You were a boy.
Floated
then.
Up and down.
Yeah, okay. Here's the other thing. I don't know how everyone, how they react when they see this map that she's done in color. But I'll tell you, what strikes me immediately, and I know Michael thinks this way too, beneficial uses. They should just leap right off the page at us. Because that's really what this agency is all about, by code, water code. They're all over the place here. And I've never seen us take an approach where maybe we map and colorize and do this. We really should be doing it, because I think it would help us to better understand what we are doing, what we should be doing, kind of what the status is. It kind of plays into the healthy vision watershed goal, you know, that we have. But this, to me, is just so important and powerful. It really is something. It's a wonderful tool. Thank you so much. I don't know if we can do this for our other, you know, waterways.
Mr. Young?
Yeah?
Can you expand on that a little bit about how you would use historical maps today in terms of protecting beneficial uses? What are you thinking?
Well, first of all, it's not so much historical, because this has current data in it, right? This is just an overlay, and so, we have...
This particular map represents what the slough system would have looked like in the 1800s.
Okay.
Yeah. So some of it's still there, some of it's not.
Okay. Well, I think what is still there, you know, should be highlighted on this. And the reason is it would inform us, you know, when we are making decisions about permits or, permits, really in our permitting process, to be able to reflect on what visually what the beneficial uses are in that area, I think it would be helpful.
So, for example, if you were to do that, some of what are now considered drainages actually are part of historical sloughs. And
in this context, with this data, absolutely. And Mr. Shemek, you know, brought this up to us about 3 years ago, I believe, at one of our meetings, where he had found on his own some historical maps, and he had told us how this area was connected with, you know, small lakes and waterways, and, you know, kind of got me thinking to that. But this really highlights and takes to a whole other level what he was trying to inform us with. So it would be in that context. I think it would be a very helpful tool for us to be looking at. We do 401 certifications. Okay. It would be great to be able to reflect on the location of the 401 cert with a current map that has both the current beneficial uses colorized, and underneath another layer or tab would be the historical ones. It could certainly affect how we make decisions. So,
And I think, I think I should let our EO respond to that. But you know, some 401 are, I mean, blue line stream come in different size, so there could be also the scientific availability of the data and the resources needed to do that. Probably on larger 401, you know, certainly I think your suggestion is excellent, but you know, we deal also with some very, very small 401s, and one, the data may not be available, and it may be disproportionate, you know, to try to get all the historical data.
That I'm just using that as an example.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly, mm-hmm. Some permits are tiny, mm-hmm. have no real effect on anything, and I'm not trying to judge those at all. Yeah. I'm just saying we make decisions as an agency through permitting. whether it's 401 cert or NPDES, and to be able to reflect on this kind of information, I think would be very informative.
Point well taken.
Yeah, and certainly it takes staff time and resources to do this, but I think it would be just a tremendous tool to have, not just in the Central Coast, but in general for water boards.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Yes.
I just want to point out that what Mr. Young is talking about in terms of looking at historical uses, that is part of our process. And Larry could probably speak to this more than me, but in the TMDLs, we have to look at historical use. And oftentimes there are, well, not often, but sometimes there are conflicts about whether historical uses actually existed. And we have to do research and document that. And it's this type of research that we sometimes use. This is way more than we are normally able to do, but it's really useful for us to have this kind of information. So I also really appreciate it. It's something that we can use when we are bringing policy documents like basin plan amendments and TMDLs to the board.
Can you inform staff at some point, like what it would cost? I mean, what it cost your agency to kind of, you know, develop this, just maybe in terms of time, hours.
That's a hard one.
I'm not asking for the information now. You can kind of reflect upon it.
Okay.
I'm just really curious what it really takes staff time to develop this kind of information.
So that's something you would like me to send to?
Yeah, let Mr. Thomas know or Ken know, Mr. Harris. I'm just curious.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr.
Thank you for indulging me, Dr. Wolf.
I won't say any time, but this time for sure.
So, Dr. Hunter, and then I'll move down through.
Yeah, it is nice that we have some flexibility in our comments today. So, in building on what you brought up, Mr. Young, I totally agree, and I think part of this is in gaining a holistic understanding, both in terms of the watershed as a functioning system of interconnected, interrelated topography and, you know, in the differences in ways that habitat functions and is sustained, but also over time. And as a stewardship coordinator, it's really, I think, important that you have developed these tools, these visuals, to convey some very complicated dynamics and helping people to understand how dynamic these systems are and where we have opportunities to recover. And I think that is where Mr. Young, I keep wanting to say Chair Young, I'll get through this. Okay, so
he's entitled to the emeritus status for the rest of the year.
Chair Young, yeah.
Only one more meeting.
Okay, I'll work on it. But I think that's where he was going with this idea, because I think our concept of healthy functioning watersheds, really, we are trying to establish a baseline. And by extending in time how these systems functioned, you know, in a earlier period where there was less modification, I think is it informs us. There's reality. You know, there are built, it's a built environment and very much modified. But I also think in our scientific and technology of today that we're advancing our ability to understand where and how where we can recover some of this and where it can balance out, and particularly understanding, you know, birding habitat and so forth being on the flyway. So this is spectacular. I think you already said that word, but that was why after we were there, we wanted to bring your group to the board. So I do have one question, and I hope it's a simple one. Actually, two questions.
Okay.
Following on that, how do you reach out to the public, or how does the public engage this type of a presentation in the region? And then are you linked in any way to the programs at CSUMB, at UC Santa Cruz, and what about the K-12, you know, public schools. How does that work?
So just speaking for myself, I have not, this is the first time this map is rolled out. I was working hard to get it done in time for this meeting. So I started about a year ago, but I do need to fit it into my other work. So my plan is to finish this map up by this summer. So you know that we're from one of the National Estuarine Research Reserves. Two other of our sister reserves, the one down in Tijuana and one in San Francisco, have been working on similar projects in collaboration with the San Francisco Estuary Institute. The San Francisco Estuary Institute is really kind of the model that I'm following. They just do tremendous historical ecology. And so they're working on rolling some of their things out into the public. And so I'm working with Gray Hayes to link up with those our sister reserves, find out how they're doing that. And then we'll go ahead and try to follow their model as well. As a steward, I spend most of my time either doing planning or dealing with weeds out on the land. So I don't do a lot of outreach, although we just had a public forum a few weeks ago where we invited people to come in and see some of the historical ecology and think about how they might be able to promote that on their land if they were interested. So I do a little bit of that, but we have a whole education program, and Gray is in charge of the decision-making training. So we have different staff to handle different parts of it. Okay. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. And then the very last question, I think it's an easy answer. The bulkheads, why were they installed? What was the function of those bulkheads?
So my understanding from reading those was really that people wanted more land to be able to use. The wetlands just weren't so usable because they were wet part of the time. And so the idea was if you could stop the tidal flow from coming in, that you could turn wetlands and more into uplands, and you get more use out of it.
So it really was about preventing seawater from moving in?
And right,
so, keeping the tides out. But there was no concern about freshwater flowing out.
That particular design seems to have been, and we still use those sometimes today, where the flaps allow water to go out, but then when the seawater comes back up, it pushes those flaps closed, and so the seawater is kept out.
Right. Interesting. Okay, thank you.
Let's see. Mr. Johnston, I think you had a question.
Sure. It's a very satisfying proposal, a presentation for me personally. I live up in Watsonville on Pinto Lake, where that Portola expedition, Father Crespi writes a few days later of Europeans discovering redwood trees for the first time. And I worked for many years in Salinas, and I commuted down every day through that whole area along Highway 1, and I would always look at those little channels and sloughs and wonder about how they had been connected, because I'd heard the stories in a much simpler form of digging through the mouth of the Salinas. So this was really, really a fabulous presentation. And I see the data as being pretty useful too. I mean, we did a workshop yesterday all day on trying to come up with a management plan for the Salinas River Channel. And we heard much testimony about the historic conditions of the Salinas River based on people who had two or three generations of knowledge. And so, it's really useful to have a deeper, richer historical context. I just have a couple of comments. One is, I know this map has been I had to chuckle at the question of what would it take to do this somewhere else. I'm thinking, 15 more years of somebody's life. But it would be useful to have an overlay of this that is in the same format, the same color-coded format, so you could switch back and forth, that is current conditions. Mm-hmm. That would be extremely useful, just to understand. The second thing is, just for my own curiosity, has any of this work been done north of the Pajaro, or are you simply focusing south of the Pajaro? I'm curious about the whole slough system underlying Watsonville.
Right, that's a great question. I am not looking at anything north of Elkhorn Slough. I mean, it looks like there was a hydrological connection to the Pajaro, at least during some years, and so to do a really good job, I probably should bring the Pajaro River in. But somebody, I think it was the Watsonville Wetlands, actually hired SFEI to come in with their historical ecology program and do kind of just a beginning historical ecology project for the slough system there. And I don't think they invested a lot of time, but what they did with just a short amount of time is pretty nice. And so I think if you go on the website, have you guys seen it? I know there's a brochure available that SFEI put together for the Watsonville wetlands, and if you Google it, you can probably find it. And it gives at least the outlines of what that slough system looked like. They use those same Rancho maps, the U.S. Coast Survey map, and I think they've got some newspaper articles as well. So at least you get a taste of what would be possible for historical ecology a little to the north of here.
Okay, I'll look it up. I have an ulterior motive because my wife is training to be a docent at Wetlands Watch.
Okay, yeah, they're a great organization, yeah.
Yes, Mr. Jordan, and then Mayor Delgado.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I echo Michael's comments, too. Whenever anybody says they want to stand up for a presentation, I sit up and take notice, so I'd just like to also congratulate you and offer my appreciation that your bouncing and unbridled enthusiasm is a great testament to the subject matter. The three of us on this end are I don't know, I guess we're still rookies, but these two guys actually have the luxury of living here. I had to drive up from southern Santa Barbara County, and you know, the two things that have impressed me in the last 2.5 years was one, the trauma of the ag waiver, and the second was the almost evangelical sense when anybody starts talking about this area. And personally for me, this is a great orientation. I'm looking forward to the tour. The evangelical part of this area will have to be a learned experience for me, not a lived experience. So this type of information really goes a long way. I think the silliest denial here of how this could be applied in a modern sense to show all these relationships of even current conditions to just where the water bodies connect, what's salt, what's not, what's a marsh, is it's just a shame we don't have unlimited resources to apply this across the whole region, because a picture sure tells the story a lot better than somebody just talking about a particular reach or talking about a particular problem, and kind of shows the big picture and the interconnectedness of all of it. So again, I'd just like to pass along my appreciation, and I look forward to my tour one of these days and getting to live a little bit more of that experience.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Mayor Delgado?
All right. Thank you again, Andrea. I, like everybody, I really had a wonderful time learning what your presentation included. Is Carr Lake on here? Is that the big blob to the southeast?
Carr Lake is the one that arrow is pointing to right there.
Okay. How do you know what's a lake, what's a slough, what's a river in this historical freshwater marsh, lake, river?
In some cases, it's pretty obvious. The Salinas River is pretty much a no-brainer. I mean, so that one's been easy. The sloughs really show up as the map as sloughs. They call them sand johns, and so that's akin to our word slough today. So that's been easy. With the lakes, this is one of these things that I still need to play with. How much should be open water? How much should be marsh? And that's where the texts, I think, are going to become very important. What you see here is reflected. The lakes are mapped as they appear in those 1906 and 1916 images that I showed you from Lou Hare. And those are pretty late in the game. By then, a lot of reclamation had already happened, especially in Carr Lake. And so these may represent a time of minimal open water, but I'm not sure. So that's, I'm still going to be tweaking that. I'm wrestling with it, with those lakes. This is the best I could do with the 1916 data.
Is any part of Elkhorn Slough's future vision or program the theoretical opportunity for reconnecting what are now maybe some disconnected? Are there any opportunities for that?
I would say there's nothing that's really far in the works. I mean, we've certainly talked about investigating the idea of trying to reconnect the Pajo in some way. We have sediment starvation as an issue for the slough. We've been losing sediment, and that's a problem for our marshes keeping up with sea level rise. And so we've toyed with it. I would say that we've not gotten very far with that particular proposal, but it's something that we've got an eye on in the future. And I certainly, for the more land-based things that I do, have been using historical ecology to help us figure out what we want to do with some of our degraded habitats. And it's been driving some of the salt marsh restoration that we've been looking at, too. We have got some pretty nice maps of where salt marsh used to be and where we can restore it. And so this has been informative for that as well.
All right. In a different venue in the future, I'll ask if maybe you could give this presentation to the WEAT Symposium, because there might be some relevance.
We can talk about that later.
Yeah. The next couple of questions are for our staff, but if you could stand by, maybe you could weigh in on them. I'm wondering if there's any place with our board and staff to work with the San Francisco Institute or Andrea to try to come up with sort of project proposals on the shelf that could be given to San Luis Obispo, Cal Poly, and CSUMB, and encourage their faculty to try to find undergrad for senior theses, capstones, and graduate students to work toward these things in our various Santa Maria watersheds, Santa Barbara watersheds, so that we could be working toward this if indeed we all agree that it has some value toward our to support our decisions. Is that something that we could do in the next 5 to 10 years, start working toward this with universities?
I don't know. I'd have to think about it and talk to staff. We hire students. The only interaction I'm aware of, and Michael can comment, is, you know, the Liddy project has a tie to San Luis through one of the staff that we interact with. But I'm not aware of us having any other kind of ongoing research or project type relationship with San Luis at this time. Do we have anything like that, Michael?
Not for this subject, but it's, I think that different universities do work in this area to a certain degree. You know, I think a lot of them do. And not to the degree that what you've presented here, but I do think other universities and their research arms are involved to a certain degree in this. And yes, I think that we could look for opportunities to increase that and think about that as we move forward and use these as examples and start talking to them about increasing their awareness about it, and I think they would be interested in it as well. So
if we could show a clear path from this kind of work that Andrea's done to supporting our decision-making, then it would probably better inspire universities that they can engage their students in something that's real-world linked. And if the steps Andrea has taken can be turned into sort of a recipe, or maybe the San Francisco Institute already has that kind of a recipe, if those steps or recipe could be turned into a project proposal that we request on various watersheds and then be given to the appropriate universities, then maybe we'd sooner get the product than if we just kind of wait for Andrea's to pop up here and there on different watersheds.
Mr. Chair, if I could comment on that. Roger used to be an advisor to the Cal Poly Engineering Department. What was he involved with, Michael? There was
in the environmental engineering.
Okay.
Part, so it's the type of work that we typically do.
So he was interacting with the engineering department, and this certainly would fall into a different department, biological sciences or something of that nature, ecology. Perhaps Ken could make contact with that department.
Well, I'm the Dean Executive Advisory Board for the College of Ag, Food, and Environmental Science at Cal Poly. And so I do know exactly who we should be talking to. And one of the professors specializes in history, and in fact, he writes articles in the San Luis Obispo Tribune on a weekly basis, and has a lot of rich information ranging from Native American Indians to what happened to the various streams in the area. So I think conceptually, and that's, I think, where perhaps we can polarize the conversation. You know, the input from Mayor Delgado is spot on, that I think on each university's covering the Central Coast, they are academics who specialize in areas of history, and we should try to tap from those resources. So I think that's a very good point.
Well, it's biological history.
Pardon me?
It's biological, ecological history. So as long as they're informed
through that discipline, then it's fine.
But I agree, Mr. Young. However, 300 years ago, these words were not used. So to us today, yes, biological history has some meaning. But if we look back at history as a whole, I think often, you know, we can gather information and translate it into what today, you know, we consider to be, you know, biological history. So Dr. Hunter was patiently waiting here. Go ahead.
Thank you. Yes, I agree, and I think Andrea showed us that the newspaper, the local newspaper of the day, would often print these types of accounts, almost in a journal sense. So there are many different sources of ecological observations, you know, of the ecology of the time. What I just want to add to the discussion on the possibility of identifying university support for helping to create a very, or filling in the gaps between what the Estuarine systems are doing, and I understand that funding, you know, to cover this work has its constraints, always does. But I would like to propose in the context of this long term, because this is, you know, we have done this before. This board has undertaken development of programs based on technology, developing, designing software, and so forth, utilizing resources, talent that we had, interests that we had from our own region, and we developed CCAMP. It became a model in the state and has helped to crank up, you know, the expectations for other regions in how they accumulate data and create these more systematic views. One thing we could consider as part of this long-term idea is that under CalEPA, we have the Coastal Conservancy, we have Fish and Game, and we have the Wildlife Conservation Board, all of whom have dedicated sources of funding, some of it federal, some of it state, but they have a very clear mission and funds that they contribute toward creating the kind of data or creating us, helping to fill in the system so it actually can perform and meet the expectations of their mission. And so I think it wouldn't hurt to have conversations with the head of the Coastal Conservancy and working. Yesterday we heard from Mr. Jeff Singel, or that Mr. Jeff Singel was here. Sorry, we didn't get to hear from him, but Fish and Game is very interested in these kinds of collaborations, but it takes a lot of discussion and planning and thinking ahead. But they do dedicate funds. Coastal Conservancy in particular has a lot of latitude, and it's hard to compete, but if you can make the connection and put it out there, you know, in a long-term sense. So I have had luck in getting funding for interns, and the CSUMB Watershed Institute is, you know, high on my list. And I know UC Santa Cruz, we have a former board member there, Daniel Press, I think would be interested in knowing of what we have in mind and perhaps guiding us through the university there to see how we can connect with different folks who might be interested in seeing this develop. So that would be another part of this.
And just another quick pitch also for Cal Poly next door to me is that, you know, we do have a pretty rich oceanography program. In fact, the pier, you know, is part of the research, and the university is always looking for great projects where it can have students, because the motto of Cal Poly is work by doing. So before, I got a couple of speaker cards, if we can maybe wrap up some of our inputs and comments.
I just had one more question to board and staff.
Yes, please go ahead.
This brings to mind to me what for me was sort of a fog when we were doing the ag waiver, when the farmers were saying, you know, you can't just look at our wells and blame us for what's underground as far as pollutants, because we're connected to other wells. And so when I'm seeing Andrea's presentation, I'm just thinking, I wonder if there's an opportunity for our board to be similarly educated about groundwater flow connections, aquifer connections, and, you know, when we talk about algal blooms, if we knew the flow of where the water was interconnected, maybe we could address the sources of the algal blooms. I don't know. It just seems like if we had an underground similar presentation and find the gaps in that knowledge, maybe we'd be not so much in a fog in the future when we try to address agriculture-related groundwater issues.
So some of that will come from the cooperative. I mean, they're doing some of that work as part of their testing, and we should have present. I mean, we'll have ongoing presentations on that, but the final reports are due March, I believe, of next year. So I would suggest let's see what they come up with and see what gaps are still remaining at that point. We all agree, the staff and the cooperative agree, that once that work is done, we will have to sit down and figure out what additional work has to be done to fill in the gaps.
So could you check in on that process and ask them if we're going to end up with some graphics like this that will help us understand the connectivity underground?
I would just suggest, what if we hold that question? You can ask them that
If you could check in with them while they're developing it and just get a sense if this is where they're headed as an output, or it's just text and graphs and tables and no graphics like this to show connectedness.
Well, what you get for groundwater flow, you typically get flow nets and other things which are not going to be as graphically pretty as the surface depictions that have been presented here. It tends to be more cut and dry.
So if I could just take a second, at a break, I can talk to you about the Monterey County Water Resources Agency has an abundance of information. They've well studied most of the aquifers in the county, and I use them as a resource. They have reports up on their website that I use as a resource. Kent's right, they're not as pretty. They're a little more technical, but there's narrative there too that you can read to better understand the different sub-basins in the Monterey County area.
That's great, because I was going for an education of our board, like we've had an education today on surface waters, to the extent that it's available, to have an education about underground connected.
Yeah. So maybe at a break I can talk to you about hitting their website and some of the stuff I found there.
Okay. Thank you.
One more comment or question, no, Dr. Hunter.
Very quick.
Because I would like to move on.
Yeah, on algal blooms. UC Davis, and I'm sorry I'm blanking on the professor who has done work on algal blooms and looking at stormwater-related discharge to the ocean and co-occurrence of algal blooms for Monterey Bay. So we there are different people we can reach out to, and perhaps that's a presentation we could look into for another future board meeting.
Okay. What I'd like to do now is we have a couple of speaker cards, and I assume there are for this particular item 12, correct? So I'd like to call first for Christina McGinnis, and you requested a couple of minutes.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Wolf and Board. My name is Christina McGinnis, and I work for the Monterey County Agricultural Commissioner's Office. I wasn't planning on testifying today, but I feel compelled after seeing Andrea's presentation and also having sat through yesterday, which was, in my mind, very inspiring to see all the agencies coming together here to discuss potential solutions to what is happening here with the Salinas River. So thank you very much for that. It was a great day. So obviously, Andrea did a stunning presentation, and her body of work is really impressive. And I very much support the board's discussion of the importance of looking at historical data to make informed decisions that are before you today. And I just wanted to touch on Mayor Delgado's comment regarding looking at different student folks to maybe help with getting some of that data together. I just moved about a year ago from Santa Barbara County, and I just want to let you know there's the Brent School of Environmental Science and Management that each year looks at projects for their graduate students, and you can actually apply to the school and request a certain type of project. And so I really see this as something that I think the students would be very interested in, and they have a Marine Science Institute there as well, and they have Coal Oil Point Reserve, which is an amazing SLU there, and it's just a tremendous area to study. So just wanted to suggest that, and thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Mr. Schimmick requested 3 minutes.
Steve Schimmick, the Otter Project in Monterey, Coast Keeper. I want to follow up on past Chair Young's question or comment about beneficial uses and what you can see on these maps. And so I'm using that map as a reference. But maps matter, and they often translate into words. And so what I'm getting at is on the 303D list, what happens is that as far as domestic water use for drinking water, what happens is that the creeks tend to be listed as domestic water supply beneficial uses, and the ditches do not. And what you see here, and this is specifically in reference to like the Blanco Drain and the reclamation ditch, they are not listed for domestic water as a beneficial use on those two systems. And so when you look at this map and you actually see the interconnections between the freshwater system of lakes that was there, and that creek, you know, which there actually is a movement on to mini movement to rename the reclamation ditch Gabalon back to Gabalon Creek. And so when you see that interconnectedness, how can you not have the reclamation ditch that is clearly that just what came from that interconnection? How can you not have the reclamation ditch having a beneficial use of domestic water supply? So that's the kind of thing where I see, you know, the rubber meets the road, and where you can take something like, and I'm a map buff, I love maps, and how you can take, you know, this historical information and you can translate it. The reclamation ditch is not a ditch. It used to be a creek, and it got renamed because of a kind of an artifact of mapping. And there is no question that domestic water use should be one of the beneficial uses of the reclamation ditch. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schimmick. I would like to summarize this item 12. You know, as a reminder, this was an informational item, and sometimes our tendency as board members is to develop action steps and directions, and often our wish list exceeds our available resources. So what I think the big couple of takeaways, and please correct me if I'm mischaracterizing the input of all my colleagues. The first one is around the value of being able to look at historical data and making good value judgments on today's decision. So to that extent, it is how can our Regional Water Board staff make good use out of historical data and the resources available. That's the first takeaway that I got. The second one was, suggestion came from Mayor Delgado primarily, is how can we leverage the universities which are within our Central Coast region to help through some of the academics and the students gather more of information. On that part, personally, I'm not sure of the mechanics on how our, you know, staff could assist there. It certainly see the value for organizations such as yourself to be able to make better, you know, increased use of those resources. I think, and I would like to get the input from our executive officer, you know, how our staff time, how we can connect with universities and try to get information. I'm not sure how realistic it is for staff to be able to pursue that. So these were the two major takeaways, and so perhaps you could comment on that, Mr. Harris.
Well, I think the first one, certainly we'll talk to staff about making sure, like on TMDLs and like Michael said, that we ensure that we're doing the very best job we can looking at historical data as part of the process. The second one, and that not just TMDLs, but other work we do. The other one on the university, I don't have an answer for you. I'm going to have to go back and sit down with staff and talk about, you know, what they've done in the past, what they know about. I think I'd like to sit with you, Mr. Chair, and talk about Cal Poly and some of your connections. Actually, the school that was mentioned in Santa Barbara, I actually gave that's who I gave a talk to 2 weeks ago to a class on how we regulate water in California. So that was an interesting connection. But I think we'll just have to go back and I would ask the board if that's your direction, we can come back at some point with an information item in terms of, you know, we can just brainstorm and come up with some ideas and bring that back as an information item.
And to supplement your input, each of us probably have some names of academic institutions and individuals that could collaborate and assist. So I would encourage my colleagues, if you have some names, you know, pass them out to Mr. Harris, and that would then also provide us an additional bank of resource. And perhaps sometime then, if there is a particular topic where we need, it would be nice to have some historical context to it, we at least have a set of name and resource, a bank of information that we can pursue. So I would like to thank you very, very much for a very interesting presentation and a lot to be learned from history. I reflected a little bit on the fact that we don't do enough of that, not just in the area of water, but you know, we're a civilization and a country where we always look at the present and the future. And there's so much to learn from the past. You know, Europeans do that pretty well because we actually have a lot of information. Well, I don't want to give credit to the French. I'll give credit to the Italians, to the Romans, because the Romans had incredible detailed documentation on what they did throughout Europe. So.
Well, we just don't have much history compared to the Europeans. That's reason we go back to what the 1700s, maybe in California.
Correct. So again, many thanks. I would like to take a 10-minute break.
Good. I just wanted to.
Yes, please.
I was going to ask John to make sure we get these presentations because I'd like to share them. It's okay with you folks with staff. I think, as we've said, you know, just seeing it will, I think, generate a lot of ideas on their part. So.
And if we approach universities,
yes,
you know. If we can show this as kind of a model, mm-hmm, right, of what we're thinking about, it would help.
Yeah. Thank you.
So thank you very much.
And a quick question to you, Chair. Can we do the same for yesterday's presentations? Because there was a couple that we specifically got agreement that they would provide us, but there were a few that it didn't even come up. And so it would be nice to get those presentations from yesterday.
Yes, Mayor Delgado. So 10-minute break. Thank you.
Thank you so much.